this show a significant decrease in the number of complaints based on the same domain renewal issues that the ERRP addresses, and effectively shows that this policy is doing its job in helping registrants with their renewal issues. At this time, I'd like to turn it over to Victor Oppenheimer to speak to you about registry issues. Thank you.
Thank you, Jen. Victor Oppenheimer, for the record, senior manager. So I'd like to give you a quick update about compliance on the registry space in ICANN 49. Starting with, of course, the scope of the compliance program on the registry space is limited by the registry agreement and any applicable consensus and temporary policies. And we cover, our compliance covers the life cycle of a GTLD from sunrise through claims and general registration. And then the audit, which my colleague Jan Agradnonik is going to talk later about it, will be limited to Articles 1 and 2. Next, please. So this is a visual representation of the life cycle of a GTLD. And what I'd like to highlight here is that there are certain obligations that are triggered upon signing the registry agreement. And it is at that point that we start monitoring compliance activities. And for example, the rights protection mechanisms, code of conduct, and PICs. And Maggie also alluded earlier about the compliance checks that we performed prior to signing of the registry agreement and prior to delegation of the string. Next. So this is a list of complaint types that for which we have FAQs on our website. We basically cover compliance covers the entire agreement. If there are, if there's no particular web form under which someone can submit a complaint, there's always a registry order. So compliance will make sure that all complaints are addressed properly. Next, please. This is a high-level overview of some areas of opportunities that we've seen since ICANN 49. Particularly under the rights protection mechanisms requirement, the improper allocation or earmarking of domain names before the end of sunrise, or the failing to provide to the trademark database the list of registered domain names on a timely fashion. We've detected some registries with or not fully compliant with the website publication of abuse contact data. Through proactive monitoring, we've also seen some registries missing the mandatory provisions in their registry registrar agreements. We've gotten quite a few complaints regarding delayed responses or denials of access to the zone file of particular TLDs. Essentially, what we see there is that some registries are denying access using reasons that are not allowed under the contract. So through the informal collaboration process, we've been able to address those matters. And then finally, we still see issues with data escrow notifications. As you know, ICANN should, per the contract, ICANN should receive two daily notifications, one from the data escrow agent and another one from the registry operator. And we typically get the one from the data escrow agent. What the ones we're missing is the ones from the registry operator itself. Next, please. And then finally, some statistics on particular complaint types that we've received from March through May. And so you can see, for example, that zone file access and reserve and the list of SLDs to block are the top two types of complaints. We get quite a few complaints too from consumers. You don't see those because we validate, or actually we guide the consumer, if you will, on why they're getting these notifications from registry operators stating that they cannot register those domain names. So we invalidate, if you will, the complaint, but at the same time, we guide them on the process and we refer them to the name collision documents on ICANN's website. Next. And now I'd like to turn to Jan Agranonik.
Good morning, everyone. This part of the presentation will consist of three different activities, I guess, if you will. First is a few words about the year two audit program. You may or may not know this. This is a three-year effort, which we started last year, actually 2012. That was a year one audit program where we audited roughly one-third of the registrars and one-third of the registries. So this year, we completed the year two program that has started roughly on the same time scale as the year one. We launched it on 14th of October. For the audit, we selected approximately one-third of the registrars and registries. Five registrars were rolled over from year one because they had some deficiencies they could not remediate by the time of the audit in year one, so we have to look at them again in year two. Obviously, all the registrars that passed year one audit were excluded from year two. That's a brief update. Later, you will see some statistics on the results of the audit program. The other activity the compliance is involved in is the new registry audit program. We have reviewed the key provisions of the new registry agreement, and based on the verbiage of the articles in this agreement, we designed the appropriate audit program steps. We used the help of various ICANN experts in their respective areas to do that. And the third activity we involved the compliance internally involved in is the internal audit. This activity is directed at improvement of our own compliance operations, meaning the objective here is to improve the efficiency and effectiveness of our operations. We identified 45 controls. By control, we mean a certain step that needs to be performed in order to process the complaint. We've found findings that we can call them a opportunity for improvement, worked on that, and everything was resolved by September of 2013. Going forward, we will repeat this exercise as needed. Next slide, please. This is a summary of that shows participants in year two audit program, which I'd like to thank for participation. The total number of registrars was 322, including five rollovers from last year. You can see the breakdown by countries. And also you can see that we looked at the six registries. The general statement on the right basically says that the 95 of the registrars were very proactive and collaborative, working with us on the remediating of initially finding deficiencies. The key word here is initial. When we ask them for information, and we receive subsequently some documentation, and if we see that something's missing, that's what we call initial deficiency. It doesn't mean that at the end of the day it stays as a deficiency. Next slide, please. This pie chart shows you that what percentage of registrars had initial deficiencies. As you can see, very few submitted the documentation that was completely acceptable and did not require any work whatsoever. Typically, This came from the largest registrars in size, where they have dedicated personnel to process requests from complaints. So other smaller registrars do need, we needed some assistance from ICANN through the communication to resolve the initial deficiencies. Next slide, please. Here you can see what types of those initial deficiencies we have identified in the comparison year one versus year two. If you try to create some kind of correlation between year one and year two, it's not going to work, because the type of deficiency basically is coming from the randomly selected registrar. So it would be difficult to explain why you have, for example, the difference in 20% in the deficiency one. It's just because some of the deficiencies, some of the registrars happen to be less sophisticated than the sum of the registrars from the year one. And if you have further questions about that, I'll be able to explain. Next slide, please. More statistics, which is, by the way, is going to be reflected in the audit report that we are publishing at our compliance website. This table compares the scale of year one versus year two audit. The most important number, I suppose, is that three registrars did not pass the RFI stage, meaning they were breached and subsequently terminated. The reason for that was two of them completely just refused to communicate, and one of them was a recent purchase by another group, and they realized that they are not interested in this business anymore, so they basically resided themselves. The bottom two numbers are also important. It shows that we, again, rolling in five registrars into year three for a complete re-audit, and 10 of them will be partially re-audited, meaning we will just look at some of the deficiencies that they have remaining because they didn't have time to remediate during the audit. Next slide, please. Plan for year three audit plan, for the third year audit program. Similar timeline as year one and year two. We're going to start in September, October. First, we're going to send the pre-RFI notice. The RFI is the request for information. So before the request of information, we're going to send the notice to all the registrars, and we're going to say the audit is coming. If you don't receive anything from us in 2 weeks, that means you are not under audit. We had a question yesterday, who will be selected for year three? So for year three, all the registrars that have not been audited in year one or year two will be selected. So the number will be slightly more than in year one or year two, because we had some new registrars that started their operations within this 3 years. We expect to wrap it up in May of 2015. The same approach, what we call compliance 1, 2, 3, will be used, meaning first we're asking for an information. You have 2 weeks to respond. If we don't get any responses, you get a second notice, and then subsequently third notice. Next slide, please. The new activity, the new registry audit program. Like I mentioned before, we internally reviewed the new registry agreement and identified the provisions that we would like to audit. What has been done so far? So far, we conducted two outreach webinars in May to registries, collected, and then we had a follow-up call in May again with the registry stakeholder group. We did receive some feedback from registries, reviewed it, updated our program consequently. Now we're presenting the audit program here, which will be on the next two slides. And we're going to start audit process in July. By start, I mean the same approach as we used for the regular audit. First, we're going to send pre-RFI notice. That is going to say that the audit is coming, and then 2 weeks later, those registries who are selected for audit will receive the request for information or RFI. Next slide, please. This is basically just a graphic representation of a timeline. Pre-audit notification, 2 weeks later you're going to have first notice, subsequently second notice if we don't receive anything, then third notice. Then there will be an audit stage where we analyze the data. During that stage, we will work with registries asking for clarifications or for additional information if something's missing. Then the audit report will be issued that will list some deficiencies, if any. And then we continue to work with the registry remediating those deficiencies. The target date for final reporting is 30th of October. Next slide, please. This is summary, part one out of two. So this page and the next page shows what are the registration agreement articles we're looking at and why we're testing them briefly. It does not show you detailed test steps, but we have them. So I don't think I should read you the articles themselves. You're probably familiar with them. If not, you can read it. It will be posted at the compliance website. But again, on the left, you have the articles under review. On the right, you have test objective. Why are we testing this article? Next slide, please. And this is a continuation of the previous table that shows you the... Oh, okay. Okay. Next slide, please. This slide shows you briefly the self-internal audit exercise results, which we already talked about. And at this point, I'm turning it to Maggie.
Thank you, Jennifer, Victor, and Jan for presenting. I know we've shared a lot of information. It's now time for the Q&A. Before we start, I'm circulating a list of, so you can sign your name and your affiliation. If you would kindly fill it out, we'll be interested to know who's in the audience with us. I know we've met many of you, but I'm sorry, it's hard to remember everyone. So with this, what I'm going to do is start the Q&A. Before you ask your question, please state your name clearly with your affiliation. But mostly, please speak slowly so our interpreters can keep up with us. Any hands? Any questions? Alan?
Thank you. Two questions. One of your earlier slides talked about the review of past performance at renewal time. And you said you take into account breaches, suspensions, terminations. Not quite sure how terminations factor into renewal, but nevertheless, do you not take into account the rate of enforcements, that is, the number of enforcements you've had to take in relation, of course, to the total number of registrations? Because I would think that a registrar that has a large number of infractions, and yes, each time they correct them, but nevertheless, that's not the kind of performance and action that you want from a registrar. Do you factor that in also?
Alan, just to make sure I understand your question, if you can look on the slide, we put it there, it's slide 7. Are you referring to the underperformance history, the termination within the last 12 months? That's not termination, just breach and suspension, which are the enforcement. Is that the question?
Yes, that is the question.
We're playing this tag again, you and I. Yes, we do take that into account.
Next time I suggest you add it, because I think it's a very significant issue. By the way, for those who are new to this room, if anyone pushes the button, it turns off the other one automatically. Okay, the second question is, you talked about possible action on deceptive renewal requests. That is, renewals from registrars who aren't really the registrar of record and such. In my experience a much commoner phenomena is getting a notice from a registrar. If you happen to own xxx.com, you get a notice from some registrar, saying this such and such company is attempting to register xxx.cn.net, whatever. We checked and we see you own the other one. Did you authorize them? And if not, do you want to buy it now to protect your brand? I see these all the time, and I rarely see deceptive renewals these days. Is this one that you would consider actionable as well?
It's unclear whether or not the ones you're receiving are actually trying to attempt for you to take action to change registrars. It doesn't sound like it. So at this time, I think the ones that you're referring to would not be actionable as a compliance matter. I think that would be outside of the scope of the compliance 2000 or in any version of the RAA.
No, it's definitely not an attempt to change a registrar, because they're trying to get you to register new names, which you have no need for, in fear of someone else using them. And because of some of the ones I've received, I know there's no one trying to register this other name. It's just such a unique string that there is no monetary value in trying to use that name and monetize on it. So it's clearly deceptive marketing, but I might suggest you may want to look at it, because this is the kind of thing that maybe we need changes in the RAA to make it enforceable. It's really annoying, and for someone who is not familiar with the business, it's a really scary phenomena.
Thank you. Yes, if it's purely marketing, that's outside of the scope of the contract and therefore outside of the scope of compliance. But if it's something that you feel is deceptive or might be violating the contract, please file a complaint. We'll look at it. We'll gather evidence and address it appropriately.
It's clearly a use of who is in determining who the current owner is, for which it was not intended, but whether that's actionable or not is a different issue.
Good morning. My name is Stefan Legner. I'm from a German registrar, Internetix. Thank you, Maggie, for your team. Thank you, Maggie, and your team for presenting. We saw some of the slides yesterday already in the registrar stakeholder group, and we talked about two changes which should have been made to the presentation. The one is with the dates of the audit 2014-15, and I've seen these changes. And the other was a discussion on the requirements for legal enforcement. And I had understood yesterday that there will be changes on the slide, and I have not seen these changes on the slides which have been presented. Could you please point out where these changes have been made?
Thank you. Yes, that's slide 17. And I believe you're referring to the jurisdictional limitations that are imposed on law enforcement reports in section 3.18.2 of the 2013 RAA. And it's the second bullet here, which we did make a change to. And just to clarify this issue that did come up in yesterday's registrar stakeholder session, under 3.18.2, reports from law enforcement entities may be limited to those that are designated as such by national or territorial government of the jurisdiction in which the registrar is established or maintains a physical office, and such reports must be handled in accordance with the requirements of that section, reviewed within 24 hours. However, if a law enforcement entity is not designated as such by the local government, it may still submit reports of abuse under section 3.18.1, and registrars will need to handle those reports in accordance with that section, which includes taking reasonable and prompt steps to investigate and respond appropriately to those reports.
Stefan, and to all the registrars represented here, I did send the updated slide deck to Jennifer Staniford and McKaylee, and they should be routed to you guys.
All right, it's Alan Woods from Right Side Registry. I've several questions, but I'll just ask one or two of the main ones, if that's okay today, and I'll hold off on the rest until the registry meeting tomorrow. The first one is with regards to second and third notices, the informal notices. What actually, where there is a period of talk between, say, ICANN and the compliance departments, at what point does that turn into a second notice? Is there a factor? Is it purely a time factor that it turns into a second notice? Or is it for a non-response?
Thank you, Alan. So we'll go into that slide to share with you. On that slide on the bottom also, there is a link to the published detailed process. So to answer this question, it is a combination, Alan. When compliance sends a notice or an inquiry, it asks specific questions, and it asks it to be responded to by a specific date. If there is no response at all, let's take the simplest scenario. There's no response at all. By the end of that day, if there's nothing happening, the next day, the compliance team will follow up per process and send a follow-up, which will be a second or a third, to inquiry or notice. It depends what's underway. Now, sometimes what we learn is, if anyone was at the registrar session yesterday, you heard me, my last sentence to the registrar, please respond to compliance. I sound like Arnold Schwarzenegger. You know, it's not a threat, but it's the better communications we have, the acknowledgement, the response will keep all of us out of trouble. So by the fact that you respond, a response can be a variety of things. You address the question and the issue. We review it. We get back to you. We close it. We get back to the reporter. We inform them. We close it, and we ask both of you to take a customer satisfaction survey. The response is halfway. We review it. If you have responded in less time than the date that it's required, within that time frame, we follow up to that notice. If you respond at that last minute, we follow up with a second notice saying your response was insufficient, and that's what we need from you still. We always attach the previous communication so that you are aware. The titles, that's why if you are in doubt, I heard yesterday in a hallway conversation, we're getting notices, we don't know if it's compliance or someone else. Our notices sound, sing, look, feel the same, all the senses possible. So they are very structured. The title should tell you what phase you're in, what it's about, and who it's coming from. So that process is addressed in that fashion. Now, the third scenario, you responded, we followed up with you, and you say, I need time to fix this. And we all know, when there are new agreements, guys, common sense, we all need ramp-up period, unless there's something that's been accounted for in the contract to allow for that ramp-up and implementation. But we do have technical issues that will need to be programmed or addressed, or an agreement that needs to be modified. What we ask the contracted party to do, we don't tell you then. We ask you, how are you going to take either the preventive action or the corrective actions to address it? And one of the corrective actions may be a plan that needs to be implemented. I need to fix this system to fix this thing, right? And you come back to us, I'll have it for you in 6 months from now. We'll come back, you say, why 6 months? What's the plan? We want milestones. Usually we don't want to go 6 months unless there's really an extremely situation. Most of the cases, it's between a couple of weeks to a couple of months. And we ask each contracted party to give us that plan with clear milestones. We don't want to have to tap you on the shoulder every other week or something. Where are you? We put clear milestones that you suggest to us. We don't tell you what the plan is. It's your plan. It's your business. but you commit to us to a plan and dates and measurable milestones. You report to us on those. And we have had amazing success with that. We've people that are in this audience and people with whom we met yesterday were perfect examples. They report to us, I have met this milestone, here's the first proof, next milestone. And at the closure, they say, we are full, thank you very much. When that happens, during that whole period, any and all complaints that we receive on that subject, we put on hold, we inform the reporter, the registrar has been informed, or the registry has been informed, and they're working on it, we'll get back to you by the date you committed to us. So that's where that trust begins. Trust with you, trust with ICANN, but trust to the outward-facing community. So when you report to us you've completed, we get back to everyone. We open the floodgates if there's any more complaints there, and we put it to the test. And if it passes, we close it, we move on. If it's not, we'll follow up with you. So there are different scenarios. It is on a case by case. There's the cookie cutter here is the process and the communication. We have to review each case and understand it. That's why we put that third bullet, fact-based decisions. All contracted parties do not operate the same. It would be easier if they did, easier on everyone. Did I answer your question, Alan?
It does. Thank you very much, Maggie. The second one, I'll dip my toe into the new registry audit program, if possible. We've seen on those slides that you provided to us, it's the same provisions that from the initial outreach session and everything. Can I just ask, as a precursor, is every single one of those items going to be in the individual audit for the per TLD, or is it per registry as well? I suppose there's a second question in there. It's just because we've seen them a few times now, it just seems that you're going specifically at those ones, and you said that today, that you have handpicked these particularly high-level items within the registry agreement, and are we looking at a full audit of all of them?
Yeah, the answer is yes. We're going to be looking at each individual item. By item, you mean the article in the RA. Yes. The only thing I want to add that it does not necessarily mean that in RFI, you're going to be asked for the documentation for each individual one, because for some of these items, we can get the documentation or files or whatever ourselves, because you're already providing it. Also, if you see that we are asking for something related to the article, but you already provided it, during, let's say, delegation or registration or onboarding, you can just say, has been provided already, not applicable, you know, this is how it was provided, this is the date, that's it. Does it answer the question?
Absolutely. As I said, I'll hold off on the rest of the month to tomorrow, but just more direct. Thank you.
Hi, thanks, Maggie, and thanks to the rest of you. I'll introduce myself first, and then I have three compliments and also three suggestions. My name is John Horton. I'm the president of Legit Script. We work with a number of registrars around the world to monitor rogue internet pharmacies, websites selling like Vicodin without a prescription, counterfeit drugs, that sort of thing. And the first thing that I want to say is, you know, I think sometimes the registrar community unfairly gets a bad rap. I think there's a real success story here. Our observation has been that, by and large, the vast majority of registrars want to do the right thing, and don't want illegal activity on their platform. And I think that's a credit, in large part, to ICANN compliance as well as to the community as a whole. I think there's a few specific things you've done that have really helped with that. I really, on our part, appreciate the guidance you provided, I think, to registrars saying, look, you know, there's nothing in the RAA that would support the argument that you can't act without a court order. So thank you for that consistent clarification. And I think also the question of jurisdiction has been important. Obviously, bad actors on the internet often want to pick a domain name registrar in a jurisdiction where they are not, so that they can avoid, hopefully, law enforcement. And so I think your clarification to our registrars in that regard has also been very helpful on applicable law. So thank you. And then the third thing is I've seen on many occasions your staff, I think, is really bent over backwards to be communicative to us. So thank you for that. I also wanted to offer, hopefully, some constructive suggestions, and maybe they've already been considered and found unworkable. We, as you know, unfortunately, have had to submit a few complaints over the years, and I wonder if you might be able to consider some sort of a ticketing system so that, for example, folks could create an account to see where that complaint is. I know that sometimes the complaint gets resolved maybe within a matter of days. I know that sometimes it can go on perhaps even months. And I know that during the informal process, it's designed so that the complainant is not going to necessarily understand everything that is going on, but it might be helpful nevertheless just to be able to see that it's in progress. And I say that with the background that there, because of the content of our complaints, sometimes we need to submit attachments. That's not currently possible through the website. And a few cases, I think, maybe it got blocked by the spam filters. So having some sort of a login process with a ticketing process would, I think, perhaps be very helpful and maybe improve transparency a little bit. That's the first thing. The second thing, we've heard this from many of the registrars we work with. We know that there are many people who submit complaints to registrars and about registrars for the wrong reasons. It could be anti-competitive. The abuse emails in Hewlett's records, I think, are getting spammed a lot, unfortunately. And we see a wide variety. We even get them since we work on behalf of registrars. Some complaints are very well-founded. Some, unfortunately, are not. And I wonder if it might be possible through the process over the next year or two to provide some guidance to the larger community about what constitutes a valid complaint. Not trying to stifle anybody's ability to bring up an issue to a registrar, but I think there's a big difference, including in the obligation to respond appropriately in the language of 3.18, versus a complaint that on the one hand just says, hey, this domain name is being used for bad purposes and I find it objectionable, versus one that says, here's the applicable law. Here are the statutes that are being violated. Here is the screenshot evidence. In my mind, those two kinds of complaints are very different and give rise to, I think, sort of a different interpretation of what responding appropriately would be. And that's my third point and probably the biggest one. Obviously, that phrase, respond appropriately, in section 3.18.1, is somewhat vague. It's not defined anywhere else in the RIA. I suspect we're going to see a lot of discussion about that over the next few years. And I wanted to encourage you to consider whether there is some way to provide a little bit more transparency in the informal resolution process and to briefly explain why. We have seen many, many cases, for example, where a domain name registrar, when we've said, hey, this is a rogue internet pharmacy selling fake drugs, whatever it might be, contacts the registrant. The registrant says, no, I'm totally legal and here's my pharmacy license. Well, the pharmacy license is forged. It's falsified. But if the complainant doesn't have the opportunity then to sort of understand if the complaint is closed by ICANN compliance, why that was, and to respond and say, wait a minute, the system was gamed here. We need to be able to provide some more information. I would argue that in that case, the system didn't work perhaps as well as it could have. So with that as background, I would suggest that you consider perhaps adding some transparency, at least a little bit, to the informal process, if possible. And then I actually wanted to raise, finally, and then I'll stop, a question. I know that a lot of law enforcement, we work with Interpol and a number of agencies around the world, has read 3.18.2 as being law enforcement from anywhere, and then it's only the, to use the exact language, I guess I should pull it up, the other similar authorities are the only things that need to be designated from time to time by the national or the territorial government of the jurisdiction where the registrar is located or maintains an office. What was the process for determining that law enforcement or consumer protection also had to be from within that jurisdiction? Because it seems at best a little bit vague to me. Is that pretty clearly supported in the equivalent of the legislative history and the GNSO documents and so forth, or is that still open to discussion?
Okay. Thank you, John. No problem. I've noted them. I will address the first three and ask Jennifer to take the last one. So the first one was about a ticket system where you have access to the complaint for status. There is a bigger picture that is being put together, what we call an enterprise solution. Not sure if you had an opportunity to be at a forum where Ashwin, our CIO, talked about it. Sorry. They are in the process of putting together a portal. Compliance will become part of that in due time. We're still in the planning stage. And the objective is for not just to push information, but also to allow people to come in for information. If you're the owner of a ticket, that's a long-term vision, but we need to be on that platform. The current platform does not allow us to do that, and we want to make sure we follow the enterprise solution. The second one about unfounded complaints, we will take that. I'll go back to the transcript. You shared a lot of ideas in there. I'm sorry. I can't write as fast as you spoke. And then with that, I'm going to let Jennifer address that last one.
Thanks for your question. Unfortunately, I'm not familiar with the so-called legislative history of 3.18.2, but I do know the contract and its provisions was a culmination of community input, stakeholders, registrars, public comments and whatnot. So I know the contract has to be broad enough to cover a range of different scenarios, and I'm sure, that's why it's written the way it is. And to address any confusion over the law enforcement jurisdiction, there is the backup of 3.18.1, which would still obligate registrars to have to investigate reports no matter where or who they're coming from. They're just going to be handled slightly differently.
Thanks.
Salim, can you please read us the question?
Thank you, Maggie. So we have questions from our remote participants. The first question from Jim Prendergast. He says, does compliance only act upon a complaint submitted by a third party, or do you act independently based upon seeing reports of possible contract violations in media, blogs, and Twitter? Example, some registry is not responding to CZDAP requests in timely manner or failing to make the zone file available. Have been widely reported. Is that enough for you to act, or does someone need to file a complaint?
Thank you. Victor Oppenheimer, for the record. Good question. The short answer is that compliance both generates notices or inquiries to contracted parties based on just the examples mentioned, social media, blogs, or our own system monitoring systems, and as well as accepting, of course, complaints from external users. And then regarding to the centralized zone data service, we acknowledge that, as I mentioned before, that some registry operators are taking or that we're getting complaints about registry operators not responding on a timely fashion. When I started the compliance update, I said that we are bound by the contract, and unfortunately the contract is silent on the time that regarding the timeliness of a response by a registry operator for a request of a SOM file. What we are advising or would like to encourage registry operators to do is to be open and transparent and establish a policy on, timeliness, and then publish it, and please adhere to that policy so at least the end users have a reasonable expectation of when they're going to get replies.
Thank you. Thank you, Victor. And the next question from Michael Fleming with Bright Consulting. He says, I do not believe this has been addressed by ICANN yet and is still likely in the planning stages, but I would like to ask in regards to compliance check for specification 13 for dot brands. I briefly touched on this during Singapore, and I was told that ICANN is currently looking at the application process for specification 13. However, now we have a process and application submitted. I've been told that ICANN a rough 9 weeks
public comment period included, to check this. Does the compliance department deal in this review of the application? If so, briefly, how does compliance check this, and is there any hope of a shorter time frame it takes to review the application? Also, in the future, how would compliance go about checking compliance with the specification 13? Any hope of a shorter time frame it takes to review the application? Also, in the future, I imagine it relates to the report that I can record within the contents of the specification. If not, would you please tell me who I may direct this question to? Thank you.
Thank you, Michael. Victor Oppenheimer again. Salim, can you go to slide 40, please? In the meantime, your first question is, does the compliance department deal in the review of the, specification 13 application? And the answer is no. There is a clear demarcation or separation between what the GDD department does in terms of new GTLD applications or requests for exemptions of the code of conduct and these kind of requests, meaning requests to grant the specification 13. So no, compliance is not involved in that compliance check. What Maggie alluded to earlier is that compliance checks on new GTLD applications in the sense that if you have a vertically integrated, for example, vertically integrated applicants, then we would check on the affiliations of that applicant both on the registrar side and if any TLDs have been delegated that are affiliated to that applicant, we would check on that as well, but not for specification 13. If you look at slide 40, this relates to your question on how would compliance go about checking compliance with spec 13. So you can see the last item on slide 40 is addressing your question. Specification 13 is part of the new GTLD audit plan, and the objective is to confirm that that only the registry operator, its affiliates, or trademark licenses register domain names and control the DNS records. Thank you.
Thank you. We can take we have two questions, Alan Greenberg, and then one more question and before we close. In the meantime, Salim, can you please follow up?
Thank you, Alan Greenberg speaking. Victor made a very interesting comment a moment ago and mentioned social media. The United States Center for Disease Control recently announced that they're now using social media, particularly restaurant reviews on travel sites, to detect food poisoning outbreaks that were previously undetected and not recognized. And I'm wondering to what extent, it would be interesting, perhaps not today, but to understand to what extent you actually monitor social media to try to understand some of the problems that users are having that they put on Facebook or Twitter but never get to put an ICANN report it on.
We can look into that and follow up later. Thank you, Alan. Next.
Thanks, Maggie. Yasmin Omer, for the record, from Dot Shebaka Registry. I do have a question regarding the registry agreement audits. Now, we did submit feedback during the outreach sessions that you conducted in May. Can you shed any light as to what feedback exactly was incorporated into the final plan? I'm specifically interested in the 15-day response timeframe because that was something a number of registries pointed out. And, the point really was that it's quite difficult to commit to a 15-day timeframe, a response timeframe, without having any clarity regarding the scope of the audit.
We actually follow the procedure that, you can see that actually it's not 15 days. You get a first notice, you have 15 business days, which is technically 20, almost 3 weeks of regular time. Plus, so if you don't respond by that time, you have another notice two, which will give you additional time. And then if you don't respond to that or respond with partial documentation, you have another notice, which gives you additional time. So technically speaking, you have three notices, which will give you considerably more time than 15 business days. Even then, if you, let's say hypothetically, provided 75% of the information by the end of notice three, we're going to audit now. We're going to audit phase. So we have another month of an audit. So then we issue the audit report that says, hey, we reviewed your documentation. We found the following deficiencies, initial deficiencies. So and again, the process starts again. You have another 15 days, another five business days, and another 5 days to resolve it. So that should be reasonable. So it's no way you have only 15 days. Does it answer the question?
Yes, it does. And so, thank you. What else has been amended as per the feedback from the in the final plan? Because the initial plan was presented to registries in May, and you sought our feedback. And you mentioned in the slides that the final plan is now being that the plan's now been finalised in accordance with the feedback that was received. So can you shed any light as to what exactly has been amended, please?
So because of the time restrictions, I committed to finishing on schedule. Salim, go to slide 42, please. But what I want to point to, Yasmin, I hope you can join us tomorrow at the registry session. But for the audience, out of fairness and transparency to Yasmin's question, we received some feedback, and some of it required clarity, and it was obvious that we need to clarify our FAQ regarding the timeline, which Jan just spoke to. And there is a slide in here, and we'll also talk to it tomorrow, where there was a misunderstanding, an anticipation of only 15 versus the full cycle and iterative process to get to a full audit. So we clarified that one. There were some clarifications on scope, and some the most important clarification, but mostly it was a request, was we had informed the registry operators that we were planning on initiating the new registry audit early July. We were requested to please give us time because many of us will be at the ICANN meeting. So that was something we said, okay, we looked at the timeline. We took down from internal staff and KPMG's effort to review the audit, and we are able to give you that additional 2 weeks that was requested. So there will be a pre-audit notification going out early July to everyone saying, like Jan said earlier, the audit's coming, the audit's coming. It's just a heads up. But then 15 days from there, an official request for information, audit notification will go out to the sampled or selected TLDs. So with that, I would like to, if you have any further questions, we'll take them tomorrow. I want to thank everyone around this room and on our conference on Adobe Line who joined us. In front of you on the screen, we have put down ICANN Compliance's email address. Please do not hesitate to send any questions you have for us there. And before I close, I owe Ray one more question, guys. He's been very collaborative.
Well, thank you, Maggie. This is Ray Fassett. Speaking from the registry operator perspective, I want to give a little bit of experience of what we've actually been through ourselves with compliance. We've been a registry operator for a TLD since 2005, but we just launched a new one that went into the root in April, second week of April. And I can tell you within the first 3 weeks of going into the root, we got a non-compliance notice with our registry agreement. At first, I was a little put out by this. I mean, we don't even have a registration in the zone. But as I then began to actually, you know, respond to it and answer it, I discovered, darn, they were right. There is something here we need to be doing. And they were pointing it out, and they were correct. Since then, we've still have not, we're just now launched our Sunrise period. Still no registrations in the zone. Registrars are just getting on board. And since then, we've gotten two or three other non-compliance notices on various issues. And each one is legitimate. There are things that we needed to be doing. So I raise this because these are all minor little infractions, if you will. But on the one hand, you know, we're learning. At first, I've come 180 degrees. At first, I was a little put out by it. Now, I have found it to actually be very helpful. I've got a lot going on in what we're doing. We got a number of TLDs. We got a lot of things going on. Now I'm at a point where I feel, well, if I miss something, Maggie's team's going to catch it for me. So I hate to, lean on you that way, but I'm just trying to explain the 180-degree turnaround. I want to take a moment here as well. If Jonathan and Constance happen to be listening, they're the ones that actually send me these notices, and very professional folks. They've been very helpful to me. I want to share this experience. And to the question of, whether Maggie was going to be ready, Maggie's team was going to be ready at the time of TLD's launching, from my experience, absolutely. They're catching the minor, littlest of things, but nonetheless, they're legitimate things, and they have to be covered. And so I wanted to get on the record here to the question that, was the team prepared at the time? If they're catching these little things, I certainly have confidence that the systems were put in place by Maggie's team in time for the launch of the TLDs, and I compliment you on that.
Thank you, Ray. That was a very pleasant surprise. We don't receive many of those. But I would like to take Ray's thank you and extend it to the amazing compliance team that I have the pleasure and honor to work with globally. Wherever you are, wherever you're listening, thank you very much. But I also want to extend the same thank you to Mike Zupke and Krista's teams and everyone else within ICANN staff who supports us. Thank you, everyone, again for joining us. Have a great rest of the week, and see you soon.